Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Yesterday felt like the day that everything in America got canceled. I mean, just kind of run through the stuff that happened. The coronavirus officially declared a pandemic. Dr. Anthony Fauci tells Congress, yeah, it's going to get a lot worse. Stock market dropped into bear territory. It is continuing to crash today. Italy is closed. Princess Cruises cancels all sailings for the next 2 months. Colleges across the country are canceling their classes. Parades are being canceled. St. Patrick's Day parades in New York and Chicago. Tom Hanks and his wife tested positive. So you know shit's really getting real. NCAA announces there'll be no fans at March Madness tournament. And the NBA suspends its season. And then the President of the United States delivers this Oval Office speech. And I'm telling you, 3 minutes in, I'm saying, oh sweet Jesus, what am I watching here? For the love of God, what is happening here? I think it's safe to say that the president failed to either comfort or reassure the nation. So trying to make sense of all of this, we are joined by George Packer, staff writer for The Atlantic, who has written some of the most important pieces in American politics and culture in the last year. So, George, thank you for coming on the podcast today.
It's my pleasure and an honor to be with you, Charlie.
Well, thank you. And I really want to get to your pieces because there are, you know, there's so much out there. It's rare that something really sticks, I think, with people, that has a shelf life. And your acceptance speech for the Hitchens Prize, The Enemies of Writing, really has stuck with me, and I want to talk about that. And also, you wrote a piece before all this, the coronavirus broke, that President Trump is actually winning his war on American institutions. And I kind of feel like it's all coming together with this one crisis. I mean, we've seen too much to expect a lot of great oratory or solace or even coherence from the president. But really, what happened last night? What was your reaction to this speech last night?
I watched it with my wife and kids, and my kids are school age. And I was genuinely hoping that this president was going to vault above all precedent, all of his history, and rise at least halfway to this occasion, because we're all in a state of high anxiety. I live in New York. It's a big, crowded city. Everywhere you go, you feel as if someone's about to sneeze in your face. We're waiting for the public schools to declare whether or not the school year is over, or at least the classroom school year is over. Everything is in suspense. Everyone's scared. No one knows who's got it. Everyone's walking around looking at everyone else, wondering, is this person within 3 feet of me? Should I take another step back? And so last night I wanted a little bit of, you know, there are different ways a president can handle a moment like this. He could be Churchillian and tell us that he has nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. It's going to be hard. It's going to demand that we steel ourselves and that we brace ourselves to our duties. Or he could be Rooseveltian and be warm and intimate and talk to us as my friends, and we're all here as a family together. Or he could be like Obama and be rational and lay it out in a way that feels like we're being spoken to as adults. Or he could be like George W. Bush after 9/11 and speak to us as a nation that stands for something that can be its best self in a crisis. He did none of that. Instead, what we had is a man staring into the camera in a kind of fixed but detached way, as if he wasn't really there, reading badly, reading monotonously, and saying words that were terrifying, not for the actual content, but for what it said about him. The policy coming out of that speech was essentially an extension of America first. This is a foreign virus. We're going to blame it on the Chinese. It's coming now from Europe. We're going to blame it on the Europeans. We're going to stop flights from Europe because they made the mistake of allowing foreigners into their countries, and we're not going to let those foreigners into our country, as if that has anything to do with where we are right now, where it's here, we're giving it to each other. We don't need foreigners to give it to us. It is as American as it is Iranian, as it is Italian, as it is Chinese. It's global. It's a pandemic. That was what was the first bit of news yesterday. And instead of either resolve or comfort or facts or reason or very concrete guidance as to how we should go about our daily lives, what we had was, it sounded like Stephen Miller had written the speech in order to make the most xenophobic Trump supporters happy and the rest of us terrified. That's what it did to me and my family.
Stephen Miller, maybe Jared Kushner writing it on the back of an envelope.
Possibly.
All of the optics were terrible. I mean, the president was, you know, coarse, he's sniffing, and this is what I don't understand, and maybe it goes back to, you know, the attack on institutions and norms. He's reading from a script. This is an Oval Office address. Historically, these are the most thoroughly vetted speeches that a president will give, and he got so much wrong. I mean, and not on minor details. These were not minor details where, you know, he's talking about, in the speech, shutting down all trade and goods with Europe, and they have to walk that back. That no, that was, you know, the restriction stops people, not goods. It turns out ban doesn't apply to American citizens, doesn't apply to legal permanent residents or their families, which is kind of a big deal. Raises a question about, like, so we don't have to be afraid of them. You could have an American who's been hanging out in Italy, and obviously because they're an American, we don't have to worry about their coronavirus. And then he also claimed that health insurers have agreed to waive all the co-payments for the treatments. And no, that's not true, just for the testing, not for the treatment. So, I mean, and this is not just partisan spin. This is not just, you know, you and I reacting this way because we're skeptical of Trump. The markets, the futures began crashing almost instantaneously. The no comfort, no reassurance.
Yeah. I mean, as you say, his manner, his tone, his face, everything about the way he read that speech, and it was read. It was not spoken. It was as if, and I kept waiting for him to completely lose the thread because he seemed to have no mental connection to what he was saying. It was just a mouthpiece at that point. And then the UK is exempted from the Europe ban. Why? UK is actually in worse shape than we are because they're behind us even in their rate of testing. So why do we think that there aren't as many cases there? Because they haven't been testing for them, just like here. So therefore the UK is all right. Maybe it's because they just left the European Union a few weeks ago. So they're not Europe anymore. I mean, none of it made any sense. What we needed was, you know, cancel your events, work from home, don't gather in large numbers. Here's a hotline if you don't know who to call, if you feel just something that would give people a sense of the federal government has thought this through and they now are beginning to get their act together and take over.
Well, and could have talked about tests. What are we doing about tests? How are we dealing with the problem that we have right now here? And I think it was that disconnect between the problem and that speech that rattled people so much. So, you know, that I think one of the great challenges of the Trump era is not saying and writing the same thing over and over and over again. You know, it's like, how many times can you write he's unfit for office, he's a narcissist, he's a liar and all of that. But I did feel last night that I'm watching him and it is the sort of the convergence of everything. That this is not just a one-off, that if you want to point at this and go, this is what we've been talking about. This is what happens when you put a reality TV host in charge of the nuclear arsenal and major crises. Because, I mean, this is really, is really Donald Trump's, all of his character and his mentality and his authoritarian tendencies all seem to come together to make him exactly the wrong man in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Because exactly, and it's not just his authoritarianism and his hostility to, you know, to any institution that isn't under his complete control. It's also his utter hollowness as a human being. There's absolutely no sense that he is worried or that he cares about people getting sick and maybe dying, or certainly going through hardship economically, personally, socially. None of that. There's absolutely no sense of that, because he has not a, you know, you're right. How do you say it in a new way? He has no empathy. He's a narcissist. He only cares about himself. And so an epidemic in which he's probably rather unlikely to fall ill himself, can't rouse him beyond himself, because it doesn't concern him except his reelection. And that's the only thing that seems to have roused him from that state of utter self-absorption, in as far as coronavirus goes, is how does it affect his reelection? And that's been pretty much the guiding question for him throughout the course of the disease.
Yeah, and I mean, you do have all of the things that we've talked about in the past, his inability to tell the truth. And of course, this is a moment where truth telling is very, very important. You know, credibility actually matters. Empathy, as you point out, matters. An understanding of the details of governance matters. And Donald Trump has been incredibly indifferent to governing as opposed to messaging. And then, of course, the concern for the institutional norms, which exist for a reason. So, for example, I was imagining, you know, on Earth 2.0, where you had a quasi-normal presidency, when they're discussing imposing a European travel ban, which may or may not have some merit, but that somebody in the room would say, okay, we're going to need to run this by the State Department, and let's at least give a heads up to European leaders, right? These are our allies. We should at least make sure we understand all of the consequences and details of that. And what was evident by the end of the speech yesterday, and particularly when they walked it back, is none of that happened, did they? I mean, the Europeans were completely blindsided. None of the normal channels that exist for a reason were used, because this is Donald Trump sitting in a room with Stephen Miller and maybe Jared Kushner and saying, this is what I want, and I don't care what anybody says. And wow, look how it turned out.
Yeah, it reminded me a bit of the travel ban from the first, what, 2 weeks of his presidency, where it was chaotic and clearly not even his own Department of Homeland Security had really been given a heads up. And then they had to bring it back because it was illegal and unenforceable. But it was that kind of chaos. And now here we are in the fourth year of his presidency. I have a feeling that speech and that policy, the European travel ban, and that phrase, the foreign virus, were the things that Trump and his speechwriters, Miller, Kushner, whoever, cared about the most. Mm-hmm. Because he, when he seemed to come alive a little bit, when his tone rose from that dead monotone of a guy, you know, reading from a script, it was when he connected his thoughts on coronavirus to America first. And then he seemed to get a little bit excited. And so the European ban connected to America first. It's a foreign virus. It's not ours. It's not our fault. It's been brought here by other people, connected to America first, to the need for walls and for travel bans, et cetera. And and at one point he even used the phrase America first. We will always, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but we will always care most, you know, or take the health and lives of America first. And you could see him kind of hitting that note. So I think that, whether because he actually believes in something called America first, or because it hit his messaging and was a signal to his base that he's still the same, even if he's going to finally start taking this virus seriously, which his base is not doing because they're being told by Sean Hannity and others that it's a hoax, even though he was changing course a little from that, he's still the same guy. I'm still your tough president. We are Americans. We're going to beat this. Coronavirus is going to quake and give up in the face of our overwhelming American response. So that was where I felt the heart of the speech was, if it had a heart at all.
Well, I think you're exactly right, and I think that's where the pivot's going to go. There's a reason why the Sean Hannitys of the world are calling this the Chinese coronavirus. What? Because it's not his fault. It's those people who are doing this to us. So let's talk about this, because among the many alarming aspects of this story is the creation of this alternative reality silo. And your colleague at The Atlantic, McKay Coppins, has a really deep dive into the way this is being spun by Trump's acolytes in the media. And, you know, Trump's dangerously effective coronavirus propaganda. I include an excerpt and a link in my newsletter today. McKay writes, Trump's right-wing media allies are working to minimize the perceived dangers of the coronavirus. I mean, Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, a lot of conservative talk show hosts are downplaying this is no big deal. This is a Democratic plot. And the reason why I think this is dangerous, and I was then in the New York Times also did a piece, and I talked to them yesterday, and I said, I'm trying not to sound too alarmist, but this spin really does pose a clear and present danger to the public health. If you have talk shows, and I used to do this for many years, who are telling people, don't worry about this nuts, you know, you don't need to not shake hands. In fact, you know, let's show that we are owning the libs by shaking hands and, you know, by not canceling events and going around. Well, you know, I mean, if you have people out there who think that this is a joke or a hoax, and they feel the need to act out their lack of concern by not taking precautions, I mean, that could be dangerous. I mean, that's not just a problem for the right wing. That becomes a threat to the general population. And I think this is going to be, they're going to have an interesting reckoning, not just politically for Trump, but for the media, because when people start dying, that's when the entertainment value of all this wears off, doesn't it?
Yeah, and there'll be video of all of those absurdly blithe and conspiratorial statements. I mean, it's as if the propaganda machine that kind of scored a qualified victory on Russia and a qualified victory on impeachment imagined that everything was amenable to the same treatment. Called it a hoax, look for every possible attack on the other side. Don't answer the facts, just change the subject, create a lot of noise and confusion, talk about conspiracies, blame George Soros. That's not going to work with a virus. The virus doesn't care. The virus doesn't know George Soros. And it's a sign of the real mental rancidness on the right that even either morally or intellectually, that doesn't sink in, that it's not going to work. Forget about whether it was fair and just in those previous issues. This is a life and death matter, and to turn it into a partisan propaganda campaign on behalf of the president because you don't want him to be blamed for it is not going to work, and it's immoral. And it's mind-boggling to me that machine, that juggernaut of right-wing propaganda, couldn't put a brake on it. This couldn't see the virus and say, "Let's slow down and move around it, and be good citizens, or look at the facts, or try to rise above partisanship." But instead, kept steamrolling right through it as if it could be overpowered, just like Russia and impeachment. Well, it's mind-boggling.
Yeah, it is mind-boggling. And you use the word immoral. And, you know, there is here's the thing that I think the people who don't listen to this need to understand is the degree to which a lot of this MAGA macho posturing, you know, basically says, you know, don't be afraid of things. You know, let's defy folks by being as reckless as possible. And the immorality is that if there is one 68-year-old woman who decides that, you know what, I don't have to wash my hands, or some 68-year-old man who goes, you know what, I'm going to go around and I'm going to touch as many things as possible, and I'm not going to wash my hands. I'm going to shake hands with everybody, and someone is infected and someone dies. you know, was that worth it? And are you responsible if you have planted those thoughts in people's minds? If you encourage people to not be careful, to behave in an irresponsible way? And I have to say that as a former talk show host, you know, you always balance out the, you know, the narratives and the memes with a, hey, there are real people in the real world who are listening to you, and there are consequences to the things that you say. And I wonder whether guys like Rush Limbaugh or Mark Levin or Sean Hannity or others or Laura Ingraham are really thinking that through, particularly if they take a moment to think about the demographic profile of the people who consume their shows.
It's a deep question. I don't know the answer. It's related to another question that I've had for a long time, which is, what are decent-minded Republican senators and congressmen and women thinking? Are they quietly, privately saying, this is horrible, I can't believe I'm in a position where I have to support this utterly unfit monster who's our president? Or, and this is what I've begun to think more and more as each new bit of evidence comes in, have they lost the ability to think for themselves, mm-hmm. or to react in the way of a regular thinking moral person, because they have so hollowed out their own independence, their own judgment in service to the party and to its leader? To me, it's a bit like the question of in the novel Darkness at Noon by Arthur Kessler. Did the old Bolshevik Rubishov confess to crimes he had not committed because he was tortured, or because he had actually committed them? No, not true in either case. He confessed because the party wanted him to. And he had always done what the party wanted. And at that point, he no longer had the ability to say no to the party. And that's where I think a lot of Republican politicians have come, where they no longer have that voice in their head that can say, I know that this is a lie, even though I'm saying it. And I think for the propaganda army, the media, something like that has happened, where it's been so good for them, both commercially and professionally, and in terms of proximity to power, that it's no longer, there's no longer a voice saying, wait a minute, is this the right thing to do? Have I crossed a line? Could I get someone killed?
Well, I think maybe there is that still small voice, but it's easily suppressed. It's easily ignored. And it's funny you should say this, because somebody tweeted at me this morning that if you administered a lie detector test to Republican senators, would they say they were okay with all of this? And the implication would be that no, of course they wouldn't be. But I am skeptical about this, because there's a habit of mind that you get into that has become almost reflexive. And I've watched it, people who I know had no illusions about Donald Trump, who now are completely on board. And I think it's because you have defensive mental reactions. Whataboutism is an incredibly powerful tool. The immediate pivot to, well, what about this crazy thing some Democrat did? And it doesn't take a lot of data points for them to say that the other side is worse, that it's a binary choice. And yes, okay, so Donald Trump has made mistakes, but look what Ilhan Omar has said here, or look what Bernie Sanders would do to your health care. And The gap between the, yeah, maybe this was bad, and the immediate change of subject has become shorter and shorter, which indicates to me that they're becoming more and more adept at silencing that still small voice. It's becoming easier and easier.
You're describing, a mental habit that we all have: rationalization, justification, mm-hmm. getting used to things, how things become normal that had seemed extreme just yesterday. We all know that. But yeah, they have to live with themselves. And to live with yourself, you can't go to bed at night saying, I'm a shameless coward, I'm a liar, I'm abetting evil. No, you can't. You know, you're not going to be able to go on for very long in that state of mind. And so gradually you shift to, well, what about them? What if, you know, of course, I don't like this, but this would be worse. Or even, what's wrong with that? Why not? And finally, the full-on, it's a hoax.
Yes.
So I think that's the way a human mind, especially in the context of a groupthink, where to survive as a Republican in Congress or as a Republican on TV or with the base of the party, you really have to think that way, or else you'll be ostracized. And ostracism has real costs. It's very ugly these days with Twitter and other things. So all the incentives are toward going along and finally washing your own brain until you can't think for yourself.
Okay, so but it's not just Republicans, is it? I want to go back to your Hitchens speech, which continues to haunt me about, because this is the problem of writers and journalists, because independent thought is difficult because it requires the willingness to break with the tribe, to go against the grain, because the pressure is so intense to always take a side, right? That, you know, it's, you know, Christopher, you know, Christopher Hitchens used to wrote, you know, it matters not what you think, but how you think. But, you know, you wrote about the flattening effect that that this new environment has, that you suppress your doubts, you suppress the nuances, because you know there are certain things you can't go there, you can't say that. And I see this on, and I'll get ripped for, you know, the both sides, and but I see this on both the right and the left, that people in fact see their role as basically more and more as a propagandist, as pushing a line rather than engaging in interrogation and an actual, you know, dangerous independent thought.
I agree. It's hard to say that because I think it's much easier to point fingers at Trump and his supporters, and they are a tribe. Some people reacted to my speech by saying, and to the Atlantic online version of it, by saying, "Oh, what you're talking about is the left, aren't you?" And my thought was, "No, I'm talking about all of us, because self-censorship and belonging to a tribe that tells you what to think, and fear of ostracism and of the social media mob, is every bit as powerful, if not more so, on the right. It's not so much a matter of our cultural institutions there. It's actually government. It's power. It's real political power. On the left, it happens more in media and in universities and schools." And in publishing. And those are worlds I know really well. Those are the worlds where I live and work. And so I've felt it for a long time, have written about it indirectly in different ways. But this speech was a long time coming. I felt like and because it's a speech, it had to be short. I didn't have time to qualify it very much or to clear my throat and cover my tracks. So it says it pretty straightforwardly and directly, and that's probably the best way to say something like this.
I just want to read one paragraph here. "The imperative to take a position can be stunting. It makes writers less likely to test their ideas against others who disagree, against personal experience, and against facts. The enviable job of a reporter is to seek human situations that constantly confound your fixed ideas. But under financial as well as political pressure, reporting has given way to opinion, whose currency, which is certainty, is cheaper in every way." And I have to admit, I read this and I went, F me, you know, because I wonder how much of this current environment it involves the suppression of inconvenient ideas, that you see things, you react to things, and you go, is that useful? Is that safe? Is that going to be acceptable? Or is that going to risk ostracism? And I see this going on across the board in both print and a lot of the people in the media. You can see it on cable television, that which leads to this, you know, uniformity of opinion, but also the way that we have dumbed ourselves down because of this, you know, and it makes for much flatter, more boring and predictable writing. And is there anything worse for a writer than being absolutely predictable?
No, I mean, probably the only thing worse is lying and being wicked.
Well, yes.
But predictability is right behind. When I start reading an op-ed column or listening to someone on cable, as soon as I know what they're going to say, a part of my brain turns off.
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, I might keep reading. I might keep listening. I might go into a stultified zone of just absorbing the flood of media. But I'm not thinking any longer. I'm not. I don't have that quickness and liveliness of responding to something new and having to think. It's the same thing I saw in Trump's eyes last night during his speech. Mm-hmm. He wasn't thinking. He wasn't having to imagine what it might be like to have an epidemic sweeping this country or to have a loved one sick and on their deathbed. So we're all in danger of being in that state of mind all the time, partly because we have so much information coming at us, partly because we find the comfort of the group to be so seductive, and partly because media itself cocoons us in this soft cotton of just words that don't point to things. And it's part of what I wanted to say in that speech is we've gotten away from actual lived experience because reporting, which is expensive and difficult and dangerous in every way, is fading away from cable TV, to some extent from print journalism. Whenever there's a reported piece, I gravitate toward it because I know it's going to bring me back to life. Mm-hmm. Whereas more opinion, it's going to kind of contribute to that slow mental death that I fear. Even if I totally agree with it, especially if I totally agree with it, it doesn't do anything really beyond sinking me deeper into that state of mind. I don't know if I'm explaining this.
No. It is. Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. That is particularly in a stressful time, you seek out the comfort food, you seek out the safe space. It is like, getting yourself into a warm, comfortable bath to hear the same sort of meaningless phrases over and over again. And if you start to have doubts like, well, is that really true? Is that really, accurate? Is that really fair? You have that, that thought policeman stand up and say, maybe you ought to, censor yourself. As you say, a writer who carries the thought police around in his head, who always feels compelled to ask, can I say this? Do I have a right? Is my terminology correct? Will my allies get angry? Well, the words will soon become lifeless, which, of course, is true. I can understand why people, say that about the thought you were talking about the left, and that's a real thing. But it's also true on the right, where there is, this demand that you must take this side and it must be consistent with your group is really, really intense. So I don't know how you break out of this. But, there was a period there where, some of us were being challenged. Well, you need to say who you're going to vote for. You need to declare this. I'm not going to listen to anything you say unless you pledge to, vote for Bernie Sanders. Or on the right, if you're not going to pledge to vote for Donald Trump against a socialist, then we're never going to listen to you again, credibility. And your piece was published right around that time, and I'm thinking, I don't necessarily just have to decide which tribe. I don't need to jump from one toxic tribe into another toxic tribe. Maybe I should be a writer who thinks about things, and if I have doubts, express those doubts. I don't need to write from a position of absolute moral certainty all the time.
Right, and if you have an impulse that you know is going to lead to some trouble with people you think of as your tribe, because we all feel closer to one tribe or another, rather than shy away from it, go toward it. That's what I've tried to condition myself to do. If I have something to say that I know is going to get me in trouble with the people I see, in my neighborhood or at a restaurant or on my way to work or whatever, then I have to condition myself, train myself to go toward it and to pursue it and see where it leads, because I know that is going to be fulfilling, a fruitful pursuit. Even if I end up rejecting the idea or not that far from where I started, it's better than withdrawing from it, because then you lose the habit of pushing your thoughts toward the truth, no matter where it might take you. I wrote a piece for The Atlantic a few months ago that was about my children's education.
I was honestly, I just called it up and I was about to ask you about this because I was going to say, you've actually done this. So you wrote this piece, When the Culture War Comes for Kids, and you must have had to take a little bit of a deep breath where you were going there.
I mean, that I got more shit for that piece than anything I've ever written. I also got some very nice responses. It wasn't all bad, but it was personal. It was ugly. And I was exposing myself to real, you know, charges of you're a terrible father. You're a ridiculous liberal. You're a racist segregationist. I was, you know, all over the spectrum in the eyes of the critics. And I knew that something like that would happen, but I didn't, until you've been the target of a bit of a Twitter storm like that, you just don't quite know what it's like. And it told me that I had probably underestimated in the piece I talked about, that was very much directed at the left. I talked about how the new progressivism had become this intolerant orthodoxy. I understated it. The reaction of the piece told me I had not gone far enough, because I'm perfectly willing to take criticism. I take it all the time, but the sweeping rejection to even engage with it, because, you know, someone heard that it might be the wrong kind of piece, that was so strong in some of the reactions that I thought, no, this is a really deep problem, this mindset where you will not listen to anything that might challenge an orthodoxy. That became clear to me. So I stayed home for a week. I didn't go out. Not
seriously.
Quite, but I was aware of, you know, whom I might run into on the street, and it could be unpleasant. Yeah.
So when I read your Hitchens speech, I was thinking that was, you were writing about this piece. You were writing about your experience. It seemed to me that your essay on being a writer and being willing to challenge the orthodoxy was specifically grown out of this experience that you had writing about the radical progressivism of your kids' schools in New York.
I think that's true. I mean, I have had battles with the left for years and years and years. I still consider myself to be on the left. I'm a liberal. That's how I define myself.
Big L or little L?
I'm a liberal in the classical sense that I believe in freedom and self-government and reason and the virtues of the Enlightenment. But I'm also a modern liberal. I believe in a strong government. I'm a Rooseveltian. I'm a New Dealer. There's nothing particularly original about my political thought. But when I feel that censorship and self-censorship are making it impossible for people to speak and to try to find the truth as close as we can get to it, that overrules all of my policy ideas and becomes a mortal threat, really, to what I do for a living and to what I think we all have to do as citizens of a democracy. So that's why I wrote the schools piece and why I wrote the Hitchens piece, because I just saw something closing in on us in our culture, especially our media culture, that threatens me. It makes me think that the things I care about are really jeopardized, and I have to say something about that.
Well, I think these are also very, very important pieces. Okay, so I want to go back to where we started talking about Trump, because you also had a piece that made the case the president is actually winning his war against institutions, which I also thought was important, because there's been a stream of commentary that I would describe as somewhat complacent, like, don't really worry about it. Trump will come and go. Our institutions are amazingly resilient. We have all of these checks and balances. And I think it is important to step back and realize we are not immune to history, and a lot of these institutions are far more fragile than we thought. So one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you today was that in many ways, what you describe, this attack on our institutions, is also what's playing out in real time today. I mean, am I drawing too strong a line? But you know, we would not be in this position with the coronavirus situation and the president's lack of credibility and all of this stuff if he had not succeeded in his war on these institutions.
I think you're dead on. I mean, that piece was mostly about the Justice and State Departments and about Trump's attempt to crush the independence of the FBI and to get the right attorney general in place who would allow the White House to dictate law enforcement policy and also on the State Department and, you know, forcing it to use foreign countries for his own reelection. We know about those. I went into detail by interviewing people who were on the receiving end of Trump's attacks and how they had become examples to their colleagues, like, don't do this or you'll end up like Andrew McCabe or like Marie Yovanovitch. But coronavirus and the CDC and public health are so personal that justice and state might not have really reached people where they live. They might still stay in the realm of abstraction. Yes, law enforcement should be independent from political interference. Yes, our diplomats should represent the national interest, not the president's own interest. But those are abstractions that don't always hit the mass of people in a really direct and personal way. But I think this does, and this will. But it's the same thing, because Trump treated a public health crisis like a crisis in his own reelection campaign and seems to have kept important officials and agencies from getting a head start because they didn't want to cross him and get too far out in front of him because he was telling the country not to worry. That is why we're 2 months behind. That's why we're about to be, I think, hit by an overwhelming number of new cases. And it's the direct consequence of what happens when a president sees the federal government as being his own personal property instead of representing the country, the Constitution, the public interest. It's a disaster, and it's exactly traceable to the same impulse that led Trump to crush the state and Justice Department.
No, and this is why this is different, though, because while we might have been concerned about the violation of these norms and the institutional damage, for most voters in the world, that was out there. It was something you read about. It was intellectual. Even when you talked about the rule of law, that doesn't affect you in a visceral sort of way. And so it didn't really move the numbers. This feels completely different. I mean, honestly, there's no place in America you can go today. There's no truck stop. There is no George Webb restaurant. There's no tavern. There's no casino that you can walk into where people are not going to be talking about this, worried about this. There's no one who doesn't have some loved one who's not going to be touched by, who won't be touched by all of this. So this becomes at a completely different level. And I, you know, perhaps we've been wrong so many times about, well, this is going to be the turning point, but this seems to really be exposing both the pattern of Trump's behavior and also his limits. And his, you know, so you and I can write about, or I can write about, his unfitness to be in office, but that's just words. Now I think it's gonna feel granular.
Right, because Trump essentially had control over those other things. He could decide who ran the FBI. He could decide who should be his ambassador in Ukraine, but he can't control a virus, and he can't control the economic reaction to the virus and to his gross mishandling of it. So, and I think he's going to panic. He is panicking because he had actually gotten used to these things coming out his way. He's going to, I think we're going to see Trump even more himself than ever, which is a frightening thought.
No, and I also think that you also have a sense of that he's out of ideas. You know, yes, that speech last night was going back to the America First theme, but I also I'm just struck. Maybe it's not the sexiest thing, but I'm struck by his belief that somehow a payroll tax cut is the response to all of this. You know, 5 minutes ago, all Republicans and conservatives understood that a payroll tax cut wouldn't stimulate the economy, but it also seems just completely just off topic. It doesn't address the actual problem in the real world. It's sort of like he's sitting there and he's got three tools, three ideas, and he's going to apply them to whatever the reality is. And I'm kind of glad that Congress is pushing back and going, okay, this has nothing to do with this. This is nothing to do with the problem that we face right now.
Or fire the head of the Fed, right? Or whatever else he can reach for. Bail out his friend Harold Hamm. He seems to be thinking of everything except what we actually need, including tests. I mean, more tests. Where he didn't mention that last night. That's the heart of the problem, the source of the problem. We don't know who has it. And then the question of hospitals and beds and respirators, and how are we going to prevent something like what's happening right now in northern Italy from happening here in 2 weeks, where hospitals are overwhelmed and they have to start triaging between, you know, the very old and the sort of old, or the very sick and the sort of sick. I think it's very likely we're going to be there in a short time. And you heard nothing like that from the president. We're alone. We're in this on our own. We don't have that leadership. But I have to say, at least here in New York, individuals, organizations are really rising to this and are doing things without being told to do them because they're the right thing to do. And so there's still a heartbeat in this country. It's just not coming out of the White House.
George Packer, thank you so much for spending so much time with us today on the podcast. Appreciate it very, very much.
I really enjoyed it.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, and we will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.